Hello, friends. I'm beginning now with a treatise on white magic video commentary for the eighth rule. This is our second program for the eighth rule, and so I'm calling it 8.2. And I had made a mistake before. I told you I was going on to program 9, but somehow had skipped program 7 in the numbering, so I hope this corrects everything. And before long, you know, this division of half my face in the light and half in the dark, very Ray 4 thing, but okay, I hope that will be solved before long with the sun changing its position, or Earth changing its position relative to the sun. All right, well, we're talking about the subjugation of the Agni Suryans of the astral plane. We don't, as normal human beings who are not masters, subjugate the Agni Suryans of the Buddhic plane. Agni Chaitans are existing etheric, physically, and atmically. Agni Suryans astrally and buddhically, and Agni Shvatas on the mental plane, lower and higher, though the ones we normally deal with are considered to be on the higher planes and are related closely to the solar angels. So anyway, they constitute the astral body and are the living substance of the astral plane. And he learns to function as an adept on that plane and to pierce through its illusion and see life true. This is what lies before us. Remember that one of our masters, or our masters in general, are masters in relation to the lower 18 subplanes and perhaps the lower 21, but they are not yet masters in the cosmic etheric level. They have not risen to all that is possible on those levels. As a matter of fact, if we were to, you know, look at this, and this diagram that Keith provided us with, we see that the two higher subplanes on both the Buddhic and Atmic planes are not associated with any particular powers, because the powers could not be understood, because they pertain to powers higher than those that a master can achieve. Chohans and Chohans of the seventh degree can achieve such powers. So there's no mastery of the complete cosmic subplane, such as Atmic or Buddhic, by one that is, we say, simply a master of the fifth degree. All right. So let's see what we have here. Speaking symbolically, the substance of the astral plane is animated by three types of divine force, which, when brought together, produce the great illusion. That is the great illusion. That's great invocation. We don't want that. Illusion of the astral plane, but not the great illusion in the largest in the largest possible sense, which is really any concrete thing. Any finitude is an illusion. Now let me just put that down. Any finitude is an illusion. Well, we can debate that at another time. So first we have the force of selfish desire. The world is rampant with it now, and millions upon millions are affected by it now. This involutionary energy plays a big part in bringing about evolution, for selfishness is the nursery of infant souls. At least it builds up the individualized self which is necessary. There are people who are not yet at the stage where they can be truly selfish in a threatening sense, hurting others. Hence, the aspirant refuses to be held by it, and note the act of will here. The act of will, and let's call it related to the law of repulse, which is the fourth law of the soul and has a lot to do with the Scorpio and the power of dispersion and scattering and detachment and refusal to be associated with. It's an aspect of the law of love, eventually, we're told, but nevertheless, we do reject it. It's a rejecting energy. But remember that, the selfishness. I mean, when we're, you know, looking at people and say, oh my goodness, this is such a selfish act, that selfishness is the nursery of infant souls in incarnation. And that's not even, I mean, the word infant is used, not even the word little ones or young people, or considering the gradual growth of the soul. But when we see people who obviously have developed other faculties to a great extent and are quite intelligent and are therefore both intelligent and selfish, we know something is out of balance, because the love aspect has not kept pace with the intelligence aspect. And that's really something that has to be corrected here on our planet, and the reappearance of the Christ and the emergence of the planetary soul on the second ray will really help with that. So first, we're talking about on the astral plane, the force of selfish desire. And if we could only change the sense of identity, but it takes some degree of sophisticated thinking and feeling and perception, then we could at least modify this selfishness, because one is only selfish about something that one considers to be oneself. And if we change the idea of what our self is and change the experience of what our self is, then we will attack and we will change the tendency to selfishness. Now, the next thing that the next thing we find, three types of divine force. Now, by the way, he calls them all divine. Interesting that they must be necessary, since he calls them all divine, you know. So let's see here, we'll make it big. And right, the force of fear. Now, this is a highly undesirable lunar factor, and it's built into matter itself, but perhaps necessary at first to preserve the form so that it doesn't become sort of a tasty dish for its enemy. So the fear is a kind of a recoiling in the face of that which is perceived as threatening. Some of it is threatening and will preserve the form. But if sustained over long, it's recoiling in front of that which would advance growth, as if it were something to be feared, you know, hiding from the light, as it were, running away from the light, running away from love, running away from the divine will. The rabbit, or what do they call, Lepus, the hare, the first decanate of Gemini. It's sometimes said about Gemini, you know, that it produces the coward, someone who is yellow, which is the color of that, the color of that particular sign of the zodiac, or at least one of the important colors. But of course, there, you know, this is just a general statement. Other aspects of Gemini involve finally Sirius itself, as the ruler, Canis Major, as the ruler of the third decanate. So anyway, the force of fear on the astral plane. This is the product of ignorance. And in its initial stages, it is not the product of wrong thinking. In other words, we just don't know. This fear is built into the lower kingdoms as well. Maybe some very, okay, let's say, this is, whoa, I think that's, I don't know how I did that. Okay, right, that was an interesting one, where I got the whole page there. All right, so anyway, this is the product of ignorance built into the lower kingdoms, and perhaps even the mineral kingdom. You know, dealing with the reaction that certain elements and metals have to their environment. I mean, it would be a foundational type of withdrawal. I think there was a chemist, physicist by the name of Bose, an Indian man, and he dealt with fatigue in metals and maybe with other reactions within the supposedly inanimate mineral kingdom. Okay, anyway, it's not the product of wrong thinking because it's built into kingdoms where there is no thinking, such as we know it. Okay, so this is because this reaction is built into kingdoms in which there is no thinking. Now, you know, there may be a reaction in consciousness, but not thinking as we know it. Okay. It is basically instinctual and is found dominating in the non-mental animal kingdom. Mars is involved there. Is it with its two satellites? There's a problem between the Lord of that third kingdom and the Lord of our fourth kingdom, two satellites of Mars, Deimos and Phobos. I think they mean something like fear and terror. Let's kind of check that out, see what we've got here. Okay, come. All right, it's all going to get a lot faster in days ahead. Hopefully we can handle that speed. Deimos and Phobos and their meanings. Deimos has two moons, Phobos and Deimos. Phobos, fear, and Deimos, panic, were named after the horses that pulled the chariot of the Greek war god Ares, the counterpart to the Roman god Mars. So let's call it Deimos, apparently, not just Deimos, but Deimos. And this is, let's call it fear and panic. So this is panic, and this, Phobos, as in phobia, is fear. And I'm thinking about those, you know, we can't help but mention certain things that are happening at the time we do this. I'm thinking about those boys in the cave in Thailand. And they were tended to by their coach, who turned out to be a kind of a former or Buddhist monk who had practiced meditation. And his meditations led them into a state of calmness. And if they had panicked on the way out or panicked while there, who knows what might have happened. Some terrible things, but it's a great example of how the world can mobilize itself. And it's a first-rate, second-rate thing. You know, the second-rate types prayed and prayed. I was among them. So were my friends. We just prayed, sending in the angels and the light and all that. And no doubt it helped create a reasonable atmosphere in which the bravery, amazing bravery of those first-ray SEALs and divers could be properly applied. What an execution. I just stand in amazement about it. But, you know, we really do need these opposites, opposite lines, the first-ray line, the second-ray line, but we need them together. They are, in a way, the great opposites. They each have what the other needs. The first-ray type has centralization, and the second-ray type needs it. The second-ray type has inclusion, and the first-ray type needs it. Okay, but in the human, its power is increased. This power of fear. Now, let's call it that. The power of fear is increased potently through the power of the mind, which can stage all kinds of unpleasant scenarios. And through memory of past pain and grievance, and through anticipation of looking back, looking forward, through anticipation of those we foresee or imagine, the power of fear is enormously aggravated by the thought form we ourselves have built of our own individual fears and phobias. Well, I'm sure we all have that kind of experience, building up what we may encounter and maybe even exaggerating the past and then imagining that if that past were repeated, it would be even more terrible. But there again, you know, identifying with the immortality of ourselves, identifying as an immortal God, and somehow proving that to ourselves is of the utmost importance. In my own case, I remember when I discovered that, you know, the inner vehicles and the outer form were separable, you know, and I found myself alive, awake, attentive, away from the body. What's going on here, you know? So I took some walks and looked at my non-self in the mirror, nothing there really. But I knew I was separable. I knew I was separable from the vehicle with which no doubt I had identified as a child and as a young person for many years. We have to have the experience of the immortal, the separability of the immortal factor. And more we'll be taught how to do that. You know, there'll be the recalling of past lives. We'll be taught how to do that. Hopefully we can stand the what we see and apply it in a constructive manner. But, you know, the assurance of immortality is based on certain experiences, not just the theory. And not just because someone tells you you are immortal, you are not your body, you are something else. We have to shed these vestures one by one. These are veils. We have to penetrate beyond these veils. We use them, but we penetrate into a reality beyond them till we find ourselves perhaps within the Augades itself, within the soul body and on. Maybe, you know, within other vehicles which have been organized and coordinated on the Buddhic plane once the egoic lotus is no more. So experience is the key. So anyway, this thought form that we run over and over again, I remember I saw a film. It was about the days of Bloody Mary in England when Catholicism was being threatened by the new Protestantism, and so they were burning every kind of Protestant they could find, especially the ones that wanted the old, the Bible and other materials translated into English. I mean, he was a man that was brave enough to speak out a version of the Bible or some verses in English in the middle of a church service. And of course, he was captured and condemned to death. And I saw him sort of in his room before his execution. And he had a flame in front of him, a candle. He was going to be burned alive. And he tried to get near the candle and touch the candle. Of course, it was a horrifying experience because he realized the pain that was involved. But we anticipate these things. We anticipate future pain. If only we could have a catalog of memories about how many times we have seen the dissolution of the body and awakened from that dissolution quite intact and very much ourselves and so forth. But we need to have that kind of flexibility and mobility in and out of the body. Maybe that's somewhat achieved, I don't know, sometimes in relation to the sixth petal, which is a Piscean petal, a Neptunian petal, a Virgo petal. Neptune is involved. So Neptune rules this coming and going in and out of the body, which is why it is the planet of mediums. You know, the medium opens the body to the incoming entity and steps aside. This is either good or bad, depending on whether it's conscious more under Virgo or unconscious under Pisces and Cancer. The Tibetan informs us. But that particular petal, the sixth petal, is obviously associated with Virgo too. So conscious mediumship may be possible. Anyway, a little digression there. Anyway, fear in the human being is not just an unconscious thing suddenly rising, you know, as when maybe an antelope is being chased by a lion or something in that moment, or suddenly a crocodile is springing out of the water and grabbing hold, but it's anticipated, it's built up over hours and days and weeks and years. The thought form grows in power as we pay attention to it, of course. For energy follows thought till we become dominated by it. And here is, well, you know, there's that old saying, a coward dies 1,000 times before his death. A hero dies but once. And the hero is not going to ruminate over the very unpleasant, possibly unpleasant rending process. Now, second-ray people, and this is something I've always remembered, and something I've applied to myself and other second-ray types, second-ray people are particularly prone to this, particularly prone to fear. The glamour of fear. Now, isn't it, if we go here to Glamour World Problem, and we go to page 123, we're a little far into it, and maybe we'll find it, you know, the glamour. self-pity, yeah, the glamour of fear, based on undue sensitivity, and also on attachment to that which one is definitely going to leave behind in the rending process. So, you know, the Buddha was a great second-rate type in his soul, and who knows where else. And he dealt with this issue of detachment. When we're truly detached from that which we had identified ourselves with, and detached because of our experience, then the fear will begin to subside. So anyway, secondary people are peculiarly prone to this glamour of fear. So search yourself, you know, and see if it's an issue for you. I know it has been an issue for me in various ways. And, well, maybe some kind of final fear is the fear of the annihilation of being or annihilation of consciousness or something of that nature. But we have to prove that these factors do not really exist. For the majority of them, it constitutes the dweller on the threshold, just as ambition and love of power, backed by frantic desire and unscrupulousness. You'd almost think about frantic desire as sixth ray and unscrupulousness third ray, but you see it in the first ray, form the dweller on the threshold of the first ray types. So this is really useful. Maybe he's going to tell us a bit about the customary, the usual dweller on the threshold for the various types. And maybe if we get a handle on what our dweller is and what sort of prevents us from taking the steps through the portal which awaits, we'll know more about our ray, or the ray that is operative in this type of prevention. The crystallized thought form of intellectual achievement for selfish ends and the use of knowledge for personality objectives stand between the portal and the path. The portal of the path, in the case of the third ray person, and unless broken up and destroyed, will dominate him and turn him into a black magician. Well, he depends upon his mind, and he trusts perhaps only his mind, and he's not willing to surrender the use of that faculty in an almost obsessive way, in the trust that something better may come along and something better that will allow him to use his intellectual development even more successfully, but this time for an unselfish purpose. Crystallized thought form. I mean, you know, we can probably, you know, put the first and seventh ray here together a little bit, and the second and the sixth and the third and the fifth, because these rays of attribute are more concrete expressions of the first three rays of aspect. The crystallized thought form of intellectual achievement for selfish ends. I remember in a debate recently, someone was accused of evading taxes, and his answer was, "Well, that means I'm really smart." And I thought to myself, there's a tremendous third ray blindness operating. And the use of knowledge for personality objectives, because we identify as a personality, stand before the portal of the path in the case of the third ray person. Remember, when we use the word person, we're not just talking about personality. It's probably pretty much the soul and eventually even the monad. And unless broken up, law of disintegration, third law, unless broken up and destroyed, will dominate him and turn him into a black magician. Now, the great majority of black magicians, how I understand it, majority of black magicians, MGNS, now I'm going to, if you don't mind, be MGNS. I'm going to make a plural out of it for the future. They come from a previous solar system and are third ray monads. Third ray monads and, interestingly, first ray souls. They're on the destroyer in terms of their soul. So the subray is the subray of the third ray monad is the first ray. We have some groups that have the first ray soul and maybe a third ray personality. Whenever you combine those two rays without the ray of love wisdom, you have a real potential problem. But anyway, they come from a system in which the third ray was developed, in which they developed their intellectual achievements that they don't want to relinquish because they're attached to them, and therefore attached to a great material deva who eventually conquers them entirely, and so captivates them that they have to start all over in another solar system. So we're told there's no permanent failure because we are the one and only non-failure, you know. But in terms of our illusory projections into the great Mahamaya, which the universe is, there are the failures in illusory time and space. There is no other thing except illusory time and space. Time and space are not real, per se. So these have to be broken up under the law of disintegration, maybe. So I've said before, you know, if we give into our dwellers first-rate types, the destroyer of souls, and maybe the law of synthesis will help. Second-rate types, the deluder of souls, and maybe the law of attraction and repulsion will help. And third-rate types, the manipulator of souls, and maybe the law of, presented attributes, you might say. That's one way of doing it. Or the law of economy in some way, aligned with the objectives of the plan, selflessly aligned, will help. There are remedies, you know, for every disease, and all of these things are diseases when they don't go along with the divine plan. There are ways of getting through and beyond them. You oft have been told that fear is an illusion, yet this statement does not help. That is so true, you know. Oh, well, you don't really have anything to be afraid of, and yet the person is in panic, and the words do not help. It is a generalization that one can admit, yet which remains profoundly difficult to apply individually. I would say only, at least in my case, I understand it, re-identification. Identification will work. Re-identification. In other words, what we thought we were, we are not, and we have to know through experience. Re-identification. The fears to which aspirants are subject, and note the mode of wording this, because the aspirant is subjugated by the fear. Let me try that. The aspirant is subjugated by the fear, are seldom of a selfish nature, except insofar as suffering has caused them to recoil from a further continuation of untoward happenings. We put our hand to the plow, as it says in the Bible, and then we turn back, and we're not worthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, we just, we stop making our directed efforts, and therefore do not build up the vibratory qualifications to enter the kingdom of heaven. Their fears, aspirants' fears, maybe we can identify that because we're all aspirants here. We wouldn't be reading Master DK so carefully if we were not aspirants, you know. Their fears are wrapped in seeming love. Notice how he gives the qualifier there. He calls it seeming love of their loved ones. DK has been through all of this. We're told the masters have been through it all. And they have the perspective of what it is we face on the continuing path. Their fears are wrapped in seeming love around their loved ones. Yet should each disciple ask himself a most practical question, how many of the torturing hours have been expended on realities and tangible happenings, and how many on illusory premonitions and on doubts and questionings based on that which has never happened? I mean, we go back and we examine what some of our fears have been. And has there been any tangibility to them at all? Has it been even worth the effort of all the torturous thinking and doubting and recoiling and quaking and all these things? I'm trying to think in my own life, you know, as an astrologer, I could pretty well, I thought, you know, predict the time of death, although there's so many variables involved there. And I might have seen, oh, look at this time. This is a very heavy time. Well, it was heavy, but it turned out to be heavy in a different way. Or this time, when things are really threatening to the bodily form, turned out that what was really threatening to the bodily form came through at a time where much less was indicated. And so, you know, I kept it in the back of my mind as I approached these times and got through them with minimal distress, only to find that later I was completely surprised and overtaken by some disastrous effects that were not, in my view, particularly indicated. So there's a lot about astrology I don't know, or maybe we don't know, and a lot about the destiny of the soul in incarnation as managed by the overshadowing angel of the presence, solar angel. There's a lot we don't know. I would like to point out to my brothers that they need to do things, to do two things, to meditate on truth in the daily life, using the concept of truth practiced and lived by, as their seed thought in meditation. And to this end, I would suggest that they memorize and use at all times when swept by illusory fears and needless foreboding the following formula or prayer. You've got to admit, this is a practical and wonderful book, which guides us, certainly. So anyway, meditate on truth in daily life, using the concept of truth practiced and lived by as their seed thought in meditation. Okay. And then use this mantra. Let reality govern my every thought, and truth be the master of my life. If we're brave enough to deal with that, you know, let reality govern my every thought, and truth be the master of my life. And then we'll really be able to begin discriminating between what is a needless, illusory anticipation, which may never come to pass, just based on vain imaginings, and what is real, or real, you know, in a relative sense. I also have to say there's nothing real but the absolute, but real in a relative sense within the universe. Let each say this to himself as constantly as need requires. So here we learn something about the value of repetition. I always say, you know, if you have a good mantra, repeat it three times. It seems to be what Master Moria would have us do. And that three-time repetition drives it home. Three is the charm, you know. Let each say this to himself as constantly as need requires, forcing his mind to focus upon the significance of these spoken words. Because you know how it is. We can just repeat something and it has no value. And Master Moria tells us that if we take vitamins with consciousness, they're worth so much more. So we try to do what we do with consciousness and not just mindlessly like an automaton. I would suggest also sound common sense. And he tells us, you know, he tells us sixth ray types do not have this. So I'm always trying to cultivate it, having been on that ray for so long. Sixth ray types do not have common sense in general, even though, in a way, the sixth phase of meditation is the common sense, or the cultivation of common sense. You know, we have a, what can I, how does it go? It's a sense, it's a, the sixth phase. sense and the seventh that we usually think of the sixth sense as psychic, but it's really the seventh sense, which is the esoteric sense, and the synthesizing sense is the common sense that synthesizes, you know, hearing, touch, sight, taste, smell, and the synthesizing common sense. So a sound common sense and the cultivation of an attitude of mind which refuses to permit time for illusory fears to grow. So do not give these fears time and attention. But of course, at first, try to identify them as really or truly illusory. I'm thinking about, you know, some people that have a worry about how they will live, support themselves in their old age, you know. The governments are getting more and more stingy with respect to what they will provide for people as they enter retirement and later retirement. And there's a fear, what will happen to me, what will happen to me, and the trust factor is not there. Of course, I think I have that, but, you know, if I've been burned enough, maybe I wouldn't have it. But the idea that God or the inner reality will provide, that our inner immortality of being will provide, is a sound one. I mean, I think Jesus said, or was it the Christ? You never know exactly who's talking there. But it sounds like the Christ that do not worry about these things that you need. Your Father in heaven knows you have need of these things. And do not worry about speaking the truth of the teaching. The words will come to you. Of course, I'm just paraphrasing, but these were not necessarily educated human beings, and they had to deliver the good news to many. And they were worried, what shall I say, Lord? You know, and he said, do not worry. The words will come to you. And I've seen that, you know, people have a fear of speaking, and they fear to be judged as stupid or whatever, and lo and behold, that in the moment, fine words and fine thoughts come to them under the stimulation of service. So we don't have to be afraid of those things. Of course, we can't overcome all of our fears at once. Some of our fears that we overcome because we have been desensitized to those fears through successful experience. Oh, I've lived through that, and I know there's nothing all that terrible to be afraid of. I've managed, you can manage, you know, based on experience. And others may remain. Other fears may remain. But they, too, will be eliminated. It's been said, is it Moria, you know? Those are great books, you know. And he says that the Black Lodge considers it a very bad sign when they find a truly fearless disciple of the White Lodge. I paraphrase, of course, but it's a bad sign when you don't fear, because the other side, the counterforce, the lords of form, they really depend on that fear to keep you all penned up in your lower consciousness. Fear is the main obstacle frequently to a very vital step forward, which could be taken in this life, but may have to be delayed to another if due opportunity is not taken and the will nature powerfully excited. Because, you know, sometimes we just have to step through and you get tired of all the trembling and you just say, look, I'm going to do this. Here we go. And don't give it much thought and just step into it. So, you know, is there something looming ahead that we know would be really profitable to our spiritual life, and yet we're afraid to take that step? Everybody has to meditate upon it. And many, many different kinds of fears might come up, you know. But always, if the next step is identified, what a shame it would be not to exert oneself in that direction and not to excite the will nature to the point where the necessary step can be taken. And here's, you know, something I've been saying all along, you know, the first-ray aspirant, namely, we're talking about the soul type, I think, the first-ray aspirant who fails to overcome his dweller may become a destroyer of souls. Notice may. Just because you, you know, go down the left-hand pathways doesn't mean you're necessarily going to become the black magician solidly in the black lodge. You may turn back. You may, you have the chance to turn back to the good way. The first-ray aspirant who fails to overcome his dweller may become a destroyer of souls, as it is called, and be condemned, self-condemned, really, until he learns his lesson to work in the forces of matter and with the forms which hold souls in prison. But interestingly enough, first-ray types really do work with the vehicles and strengthening, S-T-R-E-N-G, strengthening those vehicles. This is the occult significance of the misunderstood words, death and destruction. Of this type, the devil is the great prototype, whatever that devil is, you know. Sometimes I've associated the devil with the idea of the mentality of the devil, pride, you know, the world, the flesh, and the devil. So that natural sequence that we're faced with puts the devil on the mental side, but one can understand that we may be condemned to work things out in a very low field until we, the dweller, have acquiesced to Krishna, the soul, acquiesce to our higher self or to the Christ within us. So these are important ideas, and I don't think we're, you know, coming in contact with such people. Although Master DK says that the Black Lodge wars militantly against the progress of the aspirant, warring militantly, we would find those words, I think, if we looked it up. Let's just see if I can find those words. Warring militantly is one. And occult attacks and occult powers warring militantly against the aspirant will occur. And they may make their power felt in one or other of the vehicles, and in rare cases where the aspirant is important enough, on all at once. So this is, you know, 346 and 347 in this same book, which is very practical about the kinds of things we face. Yes, there is a militant warring going on within the inner worlds against those who seek the light, but at the same time, DK has warned us against thinking we're too important, and that really they have to, Shambhala has to deal with a lot of the evil that we mistakenly think we're being subjected to. The secondary aspirant who builds his dweller and permits, now notice it is the building ray, right? This second ray is the building ray. Sorry. B-Y-L-D, building ray. And up here, you know, the overcoming, the conquering, it's put in terms of a battle. Who's the victor when we're talking about the first ray? But with the second ray, we're talking about building something up, and permits its increasing control becomes the deluder of souls, misleading others who trust. And of this, you know, think about that labor of Hercules, the Gemini labor, and think about Bucyrus and that teacher, Bucyrus, who said, look, without me, you can't make any progress. It's the standard bit where you try to keep your students dependent upon you instead of having them become independent agents of their own progress. So the misleader of souls, the deluder of souls, when the second ray is supposed to be a great ray of light-bearing influence, bestowing light. He is the true Antichrist, and through false teaching and the work of so-called miracles, there are some teachers who have built their reputation upon miracles, so they appeared to the masses, but the explanation of how they were performed was fairly straightforward. He is the true Antichrist, and through false teaching, there's a load of it today, and so-called miracles through hypnotism and mass suggestion. He draws a veil over the world and forces men to walk in the great illusion. Well, I guess we all have our ideas about who has been, in our estimation, the false teachers of our life. Just make sure that we don't become that, and when we don't know something, we say it, you know, and when we do, we offer it as a suggestion. It is interesting to note that the work of the devil, the imprisoner of souls, is beginning to lose its power, for the race is on the verge of understanding that true death is immersion in form, and that matter is but part of the divine whole. That's interesting. So the first ray dweller is now having a lessening of power. but this is it's called the destroyer of souls, but also I have to make this bigger, because this is another way of looking at the first ray approach, the imprisoner of souls. Of course, whenever the dweller is operating, you will have a kind of imprisonment going on. The dweller has to be put in its proper place. And before we start doing that for others, we had better do it for ourselves, right? The thought form of this dweller on the threshold which humanity has built for millions of years is on the verge of destruction. This is a good sign, something that we look forward to, but the work of Antichrist is only rising now to its height. And the delusion of riches, now, you know, you see these churches where the mega rich, or at least people hope to become the mega rich, and the pastors are the mega rich, and there have been some good stories about that. Under better circumstances, the pastor goes away and comes back disguised as a homeless person and is not allowed in the church, lest the people of the church become contaminated and their major thought form contaminated, that they should become rich because of their belief in God, rich in a worldly sense. So it's really a capitulation to the third aspect of divinity by the second. But the work of the Antichrist is only rising now to its height, and the delusion of riches, of possession, of false teaching will increasingly hold sway, but the term of delusion will be shorter than the term of destruction. Somehow, you know, the bodhisattvic presence among us is usually 2,500 years. When we're dealing with a man, it's much longer, and a Mahachohan, much, much, much longer. For all these factors function under their own cycles and have their own ebb and flow. I just find every bit of this so significant that I'm just finding other colors to present the material. Now, the third ray person who fails to shatter his dweller, what do we call it? This is the law of disintegration, has to be used, becomes what is called the manipulator of souls and uses the mind to destroy the real and to put a veil between the man and reality. I'm thinking about Goebbels, you know, in the Nazi group. He was one of the ones who was, I think, closest to the Black Lodge, along with Hitler. He said, two of them are closest and most powerful and most dangerous. And I think he was a combination of the deluder of souls through the manipulation of souls. He found a way to manipulate and thus delude. So let's be sure of what we say and what we teach as sure as possible, and not make presumptions and not present ourselves as what we are not. The third ray person who also fails to shatter his dweller becomes what is called a manipulator of souls and uses the mind to destroy the real and put a veil between the man and reality. You know, the veiling part is very much connected with the third ray. Now, at the moment Jesus died on the cross, we're told the veil of the temple was rent in twain. And there is, you know, these veils are existing on the etheric plane, and they have to be penetrated and dissipated. The veil of impulsion, the veil of distortion, the veil of separation, and the veil of aspiration. So we want the unveiled truth, as St. Paul said. We don't want to see through a glass darkly. We want to see the unveiled truth face to face. It must be remembered that none of these names and these activities refer to the soul on its own plane, but only to the human souls in incarnation. And this must be stressed, for on its own plane, the souls of all men stand free from illusion and neither can be destroyed, deluded, nor manipulated. Well, I'm reaching the end now of this program. Just a couple of minutes left here. Let's see what we can finish off. We just have about 3 minutes. It is only the souls in prison who are subject to the activities of the forces of evil, and only for a term. And of course, we're all, in a way, souls in prison. We are all, at this time, souls in prison. But is it, you know, what do they say? Is it a prison which is maximum security, or maybe a minimum security prison? The first group works through governments, through politics, and the interplay between nations, and is relatively small in number, but it does imprison, you know. All of these imprison. Let's see, where's that word? None of these names or activities refer to the soul on its own plane, but only to human souls. Well, all of them imprison in various ways. If you can't see reality, if you can't function in the light of the soul, if you're confined to matter in one way or another, that's a prison. So the second ray group, who delude and deceive, work through religious agencies, through mass psychology, and the misuse and application of devotion and arts. So notice how the fourth ray and the sixth ray get into this consideration, and not only the second ray. They are the largest in number. And the third group work primarily through commercial relations in the business world and through the use of money. The concretization of prana, of universal energy, or universal energy, and the outer symbol of the universal flux and flow. These thoughts are suggestive but not vital, dealing as they do with cosmic tendencies, which have been adopted by the souls in incarnation, and create various types of imprisonment. We can be actually physically imprisoned. We can be imprisoned by the ideas we think. We can be so misguided and so manipulated into various directions of activity that it all equates as a prison. Well, okay, friends, this is the end of A Treatise on White Magic video commentary. number eight, number eight, and rules for the astral plane. Rule what? Whoop, where are we? Okay, would have to do that, wouldn't it, huh? Okay, we're almost there. I got there. There we go. Okay. Rule eight. Right. Okay, let's see. Let me do it this way. No. That's not good. I'm kind of trapped here. Sorry, I'm in the woods. Okay, number eight. Rule number eight. There it is. Rules for the astral plane. Rule, okay. Don't know why it wants to do that. Rules for the astral plane. Rule eight. And this is program eight. And we'll call it program 8.2. And then we'll have the beginning. Sorry for this delay. Beginning of a treatise on white magic video commentary, number nine, rules for the astral plane, rule eight, and it's going to be, well, it's really program 8.2. We're dealing with that. 8.2, but it's really program 9, but we're dealing with 8.3. All right. Well, I made a mess of that, but okay. I think we're okay now. Right. All right. So that's that. And we will be carrying on. It took a little longer than I thought to just kind of straighten that out. And we're on page 241. Page 241, and here we're ending on page 241. We just don't want to get lost. You know, sometimes I have to review what we've done before so we have that bridging of continuity. Okay, all the best. Let's study hard. Let's assimilate. Let's apply this very, very practical advice and not get lost in our lists and all the rest of it, but keep the clarity that Master DK is presenting. We'll do our best. Okay. We'll see you just a little later, and we'll... Everything is reacting at the same time. Okay. Over and out.